Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Robert Doyle, Deputy Director of the U.S. Geological Survey. Also joining us in our conversation from IBM is Kunal Saravanchi. Bob, I read about how the U.S. health spending is projected to continue to rise, reaching almost 20% of the GDP by 2015. We talked about how the environment is one of the major determinants of human health, but can you tell us a bit more about USGS's role in environmental health research, specifically monitoring the effects of the environment and wildlife on human health?
Environmental health effects to citizens are increasing. The U.S. proposes to provide scientific and monitoring information essential for helping the nation to identify existing and emerging environmental ecosystem health threats. USGS is engaged with a broad spectrum of partners in environmental health research. We characterize exposure, potential contaminants and pathogens in air, dust, soil, and other earth materials. Monitoring and understanding vector-borne zoonotic diseases, diseases that are transmitted between animals and people, such as avian flu and West Nile virus. We also characterize exposure to chemicals and pathogens in drinking water, food, and recreational waters. And we work with EPA and state local water authorities to identify and understand their sources and impacts.
So along the same lines, let me transition a bit to water. According to a 2003 U.S. GAO report, it said the nation lacked an adequate picture of water availability at the national, regional, and local level. Could you tell us a bit about USGS's efforts in this area, specifically around the water census, which you mentioned earlier, and modernizing the stream gauges?
The 21st century brings a new set of water resource challenges for us. Water shortages and water use conflicts have been more commonplace across the nation for irrigation crops, for expanding cities and communities, for energy production, and for environmental health and species protection under the law. The last comprehensive water census was completed in 1978, and much has changed since that time. For fiscal year 2009, we have proposed beginning a 10-year effort to undertake a water census that informs managers and policymakers as to what is available, where it is located, and what condition it's in. Knowing our nation's water assets and rates of use on an ongoing basis is crucial to effective water management. So our initiative is a 10-year study of water flow, storage, and use. We also plan to conduct regional studies comparing storage and flows with prior conditions. We'll be collaborating with state and local governments in selected water studies and aquifers as to increase use of new technology in water planning and management. We will be cooperating with states and local entities to improve characterization of the nation's aquifers. And we hope to modernize the nation's 7,300 stream gauges, to upgrade the technology to support real-time data reporting, to provide more timely information for better water management, and to stabilize the long-term network by reestablishing critical gauges that have been discontinued in the past 2 years.
Now, that's great information, Bob. As you know, innovative and continually evolving technologies have the potential to transform not just science methods, but even the questions that science can ask. Could you tell us about a few new and evolving technologies that are particularly relevant to the earth sciences? For example, what is a geographic information system, and how is it critical for integrating the many kinds of data across disciplines?
Well, let me pick up on the geographic information system as one. GIS is an information system that integrates data elements in a geographically referenced way. That is, it links to a location or place on Earth. And as a framework for understanding our world and applying geographic knowledge to solving problems, guiding management actions. And it gives us the ability to visually relate multiple data sets within a geographic context, as with a map displaying transportation routes, structures, terrains, rivers and streams, and elevation. It's valued as a relational tool. It helps us to visualize and see the interaction of data, the cause and effects of actions in one area, and how it affects the areas of the system. There's a whole host of other new technologies out there that we're anxiously looking at and expecting to take advantage of the capabilities. Molecular genetics, nanotechnology, geomicrobiology, molecular technology, environmental sensors, particularly wireless sensors, land imaging, just a whole range of new technologies out there that have an opportunity to really influence the earth sciences and how we do business.
Along similar lines, could you tell us about the National Map 3.0? How does it provide nationally consistent geospatial framework? And also, what are the key national geospatial initiatives currently underway?
Well, the national map is our vision of the future. 3.0 is our vision of the future. Our expectation is that we would have a map that is now dynamic rather than static, that we'll have real-time data represented in the map, and so that as land changes occur and that information is made available, it is automatically incorporated into the national map, that we have stream flow information connected to real-time data reports. And so that if rivers increase in height and flow faster, that that information gets accurately represented in the map the day that it occurs. And so it's a real-time nature that is envisioned as part of the national map. We also would look at an opportunity to make 3D graphics an integral part of the map, and that we would give the user of the map the ability to customize, to be able to go on screen and pick out a polygon and create their own map and add changes to that map and to do what-if scenarios and change the elevation on the map, to change some of the transportation routes and some of the structures. Our kids today are experienced with the technology that gives them the ability to do things on screen and to imagine and to think about things that aren't and to ask questions, why can't it be this way? This would give us the ability to make the map dynamic and allow people to play with it and to imagine and to configure it differently than what it is.
So it acts as a modeling or a predictive tool also?
Absolutely. In fact, even now, the National Map 1.0 is really instrumental in helping to provide the geographic context for a lot of our studies and enable us to see the ecosystems and see the changes that are taking place on the ecosystems and then be able to make some projections about some of the changes that might be occurring and how they would be represented on the map.
Just changing topic slightly, Bob, we hear a lot about collaboration and partnerships, both across government and with organizations outside the government. What kinds of partnerships are you developing to improve operations or outcomes at USGS? And could you describe specific success stories or what I would call points of pride that illustrate this approach in action?
Well, indeed, one of the strengths of the USGS possesses is a network of partners and collaborators available to draw on. The complexities of many of the issues that we face as a nation require the collective and coordinated efforts of participants, national and international, federal, state, local, NGOs, and the commercial sector as well. Our extensive network of partners enables us to extend our knowledge, expertise, and our capabilities. Some of the more significant partnerships that we've been engaged in, our partnership network in the hazards arena is a good illustration of working collaboratively with other federal agencies, such as the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA, the Corps of Engineers, NOAA, the National Weather Service, state and local governments, colleges and universities. Hazard events such as Katrina, the Southern California fires, Midwest floods, demonstrate the importance of working together to share information, coordinate activities, and to capitalize on respective resources and capabilities to best avoid and minimize the loss of life and property. We have numerous partnerships with the Department of Interior Land Management agencies, such as Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management, where we provide important science information and products that inform their resource management policies and practices, as with the strategic habitat conservation efforts or with energy development on public lands. We have an initiative with the Bureau of Land Management going on right now in the Green River area of Wyoming. Contains world-class energy resources and world-class natural resources and wildlife resources. And the challenge is, how can we develop a plan in which we can extract and take advantage of the energy resources while at the same time preserving and protecting the wildlife habitat area? Bureau of Land Management is involved, the Fish and Wildlife Service is involved, the state fish and game for the state of Wyoming. We have NGOs, we have the National Nature Serve is involved. We have the University of Wyoming also involved. So it's a tremendous collaborative effort where a lot of participants who have an interest in what's going on. And ultimately, if the plan is going to work, it needs the support of the local people. Trying to look at the issue in Wyoming on a landscape scale basis, we have individual site-specific oil wells, but it really has an impact on the larger ecosystem. And so this is our effort to try to look at things on a larger scale and to engage partners to join us in that effort and to share information across organizational lines at the federal, state, and local level.
That's great. So, Bob, I want to go back to your science strategy and talk a little bit about human capital. With the broad mission and programs that you've described, how do you envision USGS's human capital needs evolving over the next couple of years? And specifically, what are you doing to attract and maintain a high-quality technical and professional workforce to meet some of these future challenges?
Well, the rate of attrition associated with the much-touted baby boomer bubble hasn't burst, but it certainly has seeped a bit. What we have been seeing over time is that rather than have an abrupt high rate of attrition, that people have been slowly leaving the workforce. So it is a challenge for us in terms of trying to replace the institutional knowledge and the expertise, but it's also an opportunity for us, an opportunity with the science strategy that may take us in new directions, requiring new skills and new capabilities. And so the attrition gives us the opportunity to hire those capabilities to pursue those new directions. A critical aspect of realizing our science goals is an effective human capital strategy for recruiting, developing, retaining, and managing a highly skilled, flexible, motivated, and diverse workforce. Our major concern and challenge is maintaining institutional memory as a workforce retires. We have about 40% of our workforce eligible over the next 5 years. But workforce planning is an integral part of our 5-year program planning process. In 2004, we developed a comprehensive suite of workforce planning tools and guidelines for evaluating both current and future workforce needs. We currently make extensive use of the Student Career Education Program, which has proven to be a good source of future employees. And we also maintain an active postdoctoral program, both internally within the survey called the Mendenhall Doctoral Program, and we also take advantage of the National Academy of Sciences Mentoring Program. I think for us to retain and attract highly qualified talent, I think the answer is in creating a rewarding working environment where employees are valued, foster challenging, interesting, and meaningful work, and afford the employees an opportunity to excel, to be recognized, and to be rewarded, to give the employees the freedom to experiment and the latitude to fail. I want to capitalize on the flexible workplace rules that OPM has put in place over the last 3 or 4 years. FlexiPlace, telecommute, workweek alternatives, job sharing, etc. And it's important for us also as a science agency to invest in technology and equipment and the career development of our employees. I think if we do all of that, I think we will set ourselves up to be able to continue to attract and retain the talent that we will need to carry out the science strategy that we have before us.
Now, you mentioned knowledge management, and in the past year, we've seen that many federal agencies and communities have launched their own versions of Wikipedia or are using blogs. Could you talk about efforts within USGS to leverage these new societal networking ideas and technologies, and how can these tools support your mission and operations?
USGS employees have been strong proponents of social networks and other new technologies that facilitate communications within and across our organization. Our new generation of employees bring with them a familiarity and a comfort level with electronic information sharing. They've incorporated all of this into their daily life with family and friends. So introducing these new technologies into the workplace has been a logical and welcome addition to our communication tools. Podcasts are frequently used and integrated into our websites. They enable us to reach a new audience in new ways. They're a new, popular way to communicate with the public. And I would invite you both to take advantage of accessing our website, USGS, www.usgs, and to click on some of the latest podcasts that we have. And that would include the hurricane activities that is occurring in the Gulf of Mexico, as well as some thoughts about the great shakeout exercise that will be occurring in California in November. Conveying information in non-scientific terms. These new technologies will help us to convey science in non-technical terms so that the relevancy of a work can be easily understood by the general public, to convey technical topics and essential points in citizen-friendly science discussions. Our latest statistics on our web show that 1.8 million people have already accessed our sites to take advantage of the podcast that we've had made available. We also make extensive use of blogs, which have become an accepted and effective tool for informally communicating information on a range of issues or for simply sharing observations. It has become a useful tool for rapid dissemination of information to get a general message out quickly. We're also using wikis. We found them to be invaluable to us to keep our staff informed and up to date on various issues. They've been very helpful to us in the planning process in terms of with 7,300 employees located in our field locations across the country. Sometimes it gets difficult to engage them in a process and invite them in, make them feel a part of the process. But the wiki technology gives us the ability to solicit them comments, and we found that to be very effective in some of our planning documents where we invited them to comment on and participate in that process. And so it's simply another way for us to extend the communication tools and to make it easier and more effective for us to get the message out and to increase the understanding across the organization.
That's great. Back on the podcast, I'd just like to also let the listeners know that this very interview will be available on a podcast, so we can sort of extend the favor there. What does the future hold for the USGS? We will ask Robert Doyle, Deputy Director of the U.S. Geological Survey, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.